My name is Dustin Kelly, but everybody calls me DJ. I'm prior Army, serving as both a Ford Observer and a military police officer. I've spent the last 14 and a half years as a police officer and detective in a large metropolitan police department. Two things that I've learned throughout my career. One, everybody has a story to tell. And two, the best stories are true. This is the DTD Podcast. In 3, 2, 1, and we're live. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the DTD Podcast. This week in the studio, my guest spent his 14-year military career at opposite ends of the spectrum. Starting his career in the Navy, he decided after 4 years that he was not getting the fulfillment that he desired. He's requested a change to Navy EOD, but was rejected. This guest turned to the Army and was quickly snatched up for EOD, completing his training and initial deployments. In 2011, this guest's life changed drastically when he was injured by a secondary IED that rendered him sightless and caused massive injuries to his body. His life took another rough turn when he was diagnosed with bacterial meningitis, which rendered him completely without his hearing. With darkness and complete silence surrounding him, my guest started to take back control of his life with the help of his girlfriend and future wife, Michaela. These days, he's an entrepreneur, chef, public speaker, and motivation for anyone that thinks something is not possible because of the cards that you've been dealt. Please welcome into the studio, Aaron Hale. What's going on, my friend?
Hey, thanks for having me on, DJ.
Yeah, man, I'm so glad we connected over email and decided that we should do something together. And your story is just absolutely amazing to hear, just the stuff that you have overcome. And not only overcoming the things that you have, but the stuff that you do in life right now, most people with their sight without hearing or with hearing would never be able to accomplish that you're doing right now. But we always start out early. Your early life, what was it like? Were you always thinking about the military? Let's kind of go over that. How was your family life growing up?
My family life was awesome. I grew up in Northeast Ohio. It was really Rockwellian type of, you know, neighborhood environment. It was just outside the suburbs and just before the farmland, kind of in between. So it was great. It was country-ish living. And I loved my school. I loved being with the people and the kids I grew up with. My family was supportive and loving. My folks were divorced but got along. And I'm the oldest of three kids. And just no complaints. I loved the way I grew up. The only thing was that I didn't have to work really hard for a whole lot of things. I had enough natural talent to, combined with a natural ability for some BS, I could, through smoke and mirrors or just a smile or just a little bit of effort, not a whole lot, I could get by with, you know, a BC average with just about everything. So when college came around and everybody who knew how to work hard and had ambition and had goals, which I had none of, they all quickly, you know, passed me by. And that's when, you know, that first pivot point in my life came, the first decision, the critical decision juncture came up, was when I realized that I just was not prepared for college and needed to do something about my work ethic and values.
When you talk about your work ethic, of course, a lot of that has changed in your life. I think we can both agree on that, because nothing, I would say, comes easy now. It's been a lot of work. It's been an uphill battle. But when you look back on that, does it upset you when you think that maybe you weren't doing your full potential back then?
I certainly wasn't I wasn't achieving a whole lot. You know, I was enjoying the day to day, and there were spurts of that potential, that promise. You know, when I played football, or I started a few entrepreneurial ventures in school. You know, when I had a goal to work towards, I worked really hard, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And then I'd reach that goal and accomplish that mission, and I think, phew, that's over. Now I can kick my feet up and do nothing, and you know, watch TV, play video games, hang out with my buddies. And I didn't develop habits around the achievement. Good habits weren't developed, and that's what I really needed. That's when I turned to, you know, after college, that's when I turned to the military, because that's exactly what I needed. I needed, one, to earn that tuition money back that I just pissed away. Also to work off the freshman 50. But most of all, I really needed to figure out what my goals, my values, and really get that work ethic and be proud of working towards something on a daily basis. Process.
How about your siblings? Were they focused? Were they driven? Or was it kind of the same thing with them?
My sister was. She was very studious. She had to work hard. I think, in fact, I believe she might have been a little peeved that things came to me pretty easily without having to try too hard. Even though she was getting better grades than me, she was working a lot harder to get them. And my younger brother, we're all 3 years apart, so he was 6 years younger than me. And frankly, that's enough of a separation that by the time he hit middle and then high school, I was through college or out of college and overseas by then. He didn't have much ambition for college. He decided to go roadside construction. And as far as I know, he took quite a bit of pride in a day's hard work.
You join the Navy first. 1999 is when you go in. Is it everything that you thought it was going to be?
You know, I wasn't quite sure what to expect in Navy, especially like Navy basic. Yeah, you see those like platoon, full metal jacket, like standing on the yellow line, drill sergeants yelling at you, but it's the Navy. You know, it's not the same. at the time, they did, it was a rifle. They actually did a marksmanship, I wouldn't call it training. It was like half a day, and it was a glorified duck hunt. You got this rifle-shaped thing with a long cable connected to some computer in another room. You pointed it at a wall, and you pulled the trigger. It just went click, and then they said, okay, leave the room. What was that? I don't know. And that was literally my rifle training in the Navy. But I don't know if they still do that or what they do, but there were other things. I mean, it's Navy training, so you actually train to fight fires. You train to patch pipes, do like all branches. You do a bunch of marching, eating, PT, and learning what it means to be a sailor or airman, you know, soldier, marine. And then I went to Navy A school, learned how to be a Navy cook. And I've been cooking since I could reach over the counter. My whole family, also very creative. My mom and my brother, very gifted sketch artists and painters. But my creative spark led me into the kitchen. I love the culinary arts. So I decided I wanted to be a chef. And for my 4 years maximum in the Navy, I would be a Navy cook, the military equivalent. Only thing is, the Navy thinks of the at the time, it was mess management specialist. They changed it to culinary specialist because that was a mouthful. They considered it more like hotel restaurant management on the civilian side. So when I got to my first duty station, it was shore duty in Naples, Italy. I asked where I was going to be cooking. And they said, oh, no. We don't cook when we're on shore. That's civilians. We run the barracks. And I, well, of course, that makes sense. So my first duty station, my first job in the Navy as a Navy cook was, and you know, the FNG was the night desk clerk at the BEQ and the Navy Lodge at Capita Kino, Naples. So I would hand out, you know, lost room keys and check in new sailors and give them that trash bag full of linens and run trouble call tickets. That's about it. Over the course of 2 years, I worked my way up to the maintenance department. So I was now, I would then take the trouble call tickets from the front desk and escort public works, local nationals, the Italians, to the rooms to do fix and make repairs. And it was so funny because all day long I would just point around and say, como si dice, how do you say this, how do you say that? And I was learning Italian from a bunch of Neapolitan roughnecks, you know, plumbers, electricians. And it was so funny because anytime I got some liberty, you know, some leave time to travel around Italy, they would, all the Italians look at me like, you're an American from Naples. You're trying. It's nice. But let's just speak in English.
Well, I got to ask you, though, that's got to be a huge disappointment because you come in to kind of give it your all. You said that you really needed that focus and stuff. You come in and do the job, but you don't even come in and really do the job that you came in for. Now, I know that that came later on. And I know that you really can't complain. You're in Naples, Italy, as, you know, what, a 20, 21, 22-year-old. But as you move through this, you take over as not only cooking, but you're cooking for an admiral, correct?
Right. Yeah, the thing is, I spent 4 years in Naples at two different duty stations. After my 2 years in Naples at PCS, I moved to another command, the commander of the 6th Fleet. And the truth was, I was learning the skills that were necessary. I just didn't realize it at the time. I was disappointed in my job assignment, but I was also taking leadership roles. I was learning, you know, how to lead, how to communicate, how to be a good sailor, well-rounded sailor. I was promoted ahead of my peers, and when it came time to change duty stations, a flag billet came up, and it was a special duty assignment, which meant it needed a recommendation from the commanding officer. But the thing was, you know, coming from the maintenance department to cooking for a 3-star admiral is kind of a difficult jump. But also over the course of those couple of years, I'd volunteered to help the commanding officer throw his receptions. So I was doing catering jobs on the side as a collateral duty for the commanding officer and his wife at his, you know, Italian villa. And so when it came up to cook for the admiral and I needed a recommendation, the commander, you know, gladly did. And I moved into that billet. So then I'm, you know, cooking for this pirate born 200 years too late. It was hilarious because I was living in Italy. I was learning the Italian cuisine. I was learning the lingo. I was learning, you know, the appreciation, the wine and all this stuff. I mean, hardship duty was not. But the import, the admiral had one rule. We were not allowed to make Italian food. Why would he have the American cooks make it when he could just go off the boat? But see, that we were doing well. I went from, you know, running trouble call tickets to cooking for the admiral and about 35 of his top brass. and it was fantastic. But I joined in 99, and then it was all of a sudden 2003, 2004, and we find ourselves in two major operations in the Middle East, and we're out at sea and we're at war. And I'm watching war happen on the TV. Yeah, my job is as important as everybody else's, but I along the way, not only did I develop those internal values, internal skills, I was starting to get that external thing, the gratitude for the service members around me, a loyalty, a duty, that selfless service, and respect for my military service. So I wanted to play a part in the effort, and I didn't think that being a cook in the Navy was the highest and best use of my skills and abilities. So that I could do a whole lot about it. I did request to deploy to Afghanistan as a cook, and I ran an army chow hall. So I went from cooking for the admiral on his staff to cooking for like 600 NATO troops in Farah, Afghanistan, and that's when I met some EOD techs and started learning about that job.
You decide to do this, and I understand why you did the EOD route because you're talking to these guys. I'm trying to figure out, though, why it was such a tough transition for the Navy to slide you over into EOD, and it was relatively painless for the Army to do it for you.
There were a couple of things. For one, the Navy had trained me to be a cook. And at the time, Navy cooks and my rank, like my rank, I was E5, Petty Officer Second Class, was undermanned. And Petty Officer First Class, next rank up, E6, was overmanned. So they needed me to stay put. That was the needs of the Navy. Also, at the time, EOD in the Navy wasn't a rank or an MOS itself. It was a special qualification. It was like a suffix. We would put it in the Navy, we would put it in parentheses behind the name. Later would become its own rate or, MOS. But at the time, they were taking only source rates. You come from certain job fields like master at arms or bosun's mate or electrician tech, but they just weren't taking cooks. Everything can be wavered, but nobody wants to tell you. So I put in the request, they denied it, and I just didn't know I could, try again or, ask for a waiver or anything like that. I just knew that my contract was coming up. Didn't look like I was stuck where I was going to be for a while. Same rank, same rate. I knew what I wanted to do. It didn't matter what uniform I was in. I had grown to love the Navy, but I knew I had a mission. I had a goal. So when my contract expired, I went over to the Army recruiter, and they didn't have any problem. They welcomed me in. They asked me if I wanted to keep my rank. I said, sure. Yeah, that sounds great. And they signed me right up. I became a sergeant in the Army, and they sent me to some, it was like a gentleman's version of a basic training. And then it was to EOD school.
Here's what I got to ask you though. And I think about it all the time whenever I hear your story, read about your story. You said that you had a mission to become EOD. That was your goal to do. The first question I have to that is, do you think that everything happens for a reason?
I'm not sure about if everything has a specific reason, if there's destiny. I believe we drive our destiny with every decision we make. So not making a decision is a decision. The choice to not get up in the morning is a decision. And we've chosen our fate for that day and for the rest of our lives. I chose not to work hard in college and ended up choosing the military. I chose not, I chose not to stay as a Navy cook and wanted to deploy. So I found a way to do that. And that, you know, certain things by the choices and the preparations and, you know, the way we open ourselves up to things, present themselves in a different way, a different light. You know, it's the same as if, you look at things from an optimistic or a pessimistic view. You'll look at something as an opportunity or an obstacle. And when I met the EOD technicians, I could have just ignored what they were doing and went about my daily business and been a cook, you know, for the rest of the deployment. And I would have, you know, deployed to, you know, to a war zone and maybe felt like I'd accomplished what I set out to do. I don't think so. I made the decision path that brought the EOD techs to me or me to them. And it was exactly what was supposed to happen because of choices.
So the second part to that question would be, and I love how you answered that. The second part would be, with everything that's happened, with what you've lost, what you've gained, because I think we can both agree that there has been loss and gain in all of this. With everything that's happened, would you do it again if you knew back then what you know now?
That's an impossible question. I know I get it. I've gotten it before, and I've tried to answer it. And because the thing is, you know how hard it is to knowingly stab yourself in the hand. There's like a trigger. There's something in your brain that says that's gonna hurt. Don't do that. Now imagine knowingly stepping on an IED. Knowing what's going to happen next, would I make that same decision? The thing is, and I know what you're getting at, would I sacrifice my eyes? Would I sacrifice my ears for the life I have now? Would I do that again? And I don't know. I don't know what life I would have been given up, but I definitely know if I don't make the same decisions this second time, I do know what life I would be giving up that I have now. And it's a pretty incredible one. I also know the decisions and the choices and the work I did as an EOD tech and with the team that I had, we took a lot of hazardous devices off the battlefield and we saved lives.
Well, let's talk about that real quick. Your unit had over 1,100 counter IED missions. You took over 20,000 pounds of enemy explosives off the battlefield. And you personally, on the deployment that you were disabled on, you personally disarmed 50 bombs.
Yeah. We were in a very, very hot area. It was a very busy location. And it wasn't like we were fighting the enemy. We were just... There were just so many IEDs buried all over the place. It was the same thing all the time. You know, an oil jug with homemade explosives, some lamp cord, and a plywood pressure plate with a 9-volt battery. Everywhere. They were all over the place. Every once in a while, we'd get a little anti-personnel landmine. Every once in a while, we'd get some Chinese or Iranian mortars. But then those would be, you know, connected to a 9-volt battery and a pressure plate because they don't know how to do anything else. They just find some explosive and connect it to some lamp cord and a 9-volt. But they're everywhere. So, yeah, we were digging these things up left and right for months. Every once in a while, we get lucky and find a cache of these things just stacked, ready to go out and get buried. Most of the time, we'd have to do the digging.
I want to go back for a second, though, when we were talking about would you make that decision. The reason I ask that is you got part of it by saying, would you give up the life? But I look at it even like this. I don't know that you meet your wife I mean, you knew her before, but I don't know if it turns into that relationship. Your children, the mountain climbing, the marathons, all of these things, none of that happens. And I understand also what you're saying about, do you know how hard it is to stab yourself in the hand, that it's going to suck, but you do it anyway. I think when I ask you that question, it is a very difficult question to answer, and it's maybe even an unfair question to ask. But I almost wonder, when you think about it, because there were times where, I mean, it's a darkness that happened to you for like 6 months at a time when you have no hearing, no sight, and you think about all those things. I just am trying to figure out that mentality behind it. How you, one, push through it, and would you do it again if you could?
You know, the noble side of me wants to say, well, of course I would. You know, I'm doing an important job. And we all put on that uniform. We all know we're stepping into perpetual and possible danger. And there may be, you know, an IED out there, or an unexploded ordnance, a bullet with our name on it. And I'd like to say I would. You know, the human side of me says that, you know, live to fight another day. But my life is so rich today. And as much as I'd want to see my three sons and my parents' faces, and as much as I'd love to watch a sunrise or hear the Black Keys play again, or, you know, all those things that I'm missing, I'm so grateful for the life I have. And I really don't think I'd want to change a thing. I still am alive. I'm healthy. I have a fit mind. I'm married to a wonderful woman. I still get to be dad to these awesome three boys. And I'm an entrepreneur. You know, I'm an employer and an investor, speaker. I have an incredibly crazy story that I get to tell others and inspire others with. And I get to do also equally crazy things like, you know, like I just ran Bad Water last week. Life is an adventure and you have your ups and downs. And I'd still like to say, yes, I would make every decision the same way.
Let's go back to your first deployment as an EOD. From everything that I'm understanding, it's your second deployment as EOD where the accident happens. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's my third overall deployment, my second as an EOD tech.
Okay.
Now, so I went to Afghanistan as a Navy cook. I went to Iraq as an EOD sergeant. And then I went back to Afghanistan in 2011 as an EOD staff sergeant and team leader.
Okay. Let's talk about that first one. So you have this deployment to Afghanistan as a Navy cook. It doesn't really fulfill you on your ideas of what you could really give in terms of service. You get over to Iraq as an EOD sergeant, which is in itself crazy that you come into the Army and you're an EOD sergeant, which means you have all kinds of responsibility and you're new to this field. You got to tell me how you feel when you get there. There's got to be a ton of nerves. There's got to be a lot of pressure on you to show these guys, yes, I'm new around here. Yes, I'm new to this job, but I know what I'm doing.
You're absolutely right. Not only am I new to EOD, but I'm new to the Army. And it's an entirely different, you know, language, you know, culture. So I might have this rank, but I haven't, you know, earned my, you know, my stripes, so to speak, in the Army or in EOD, more importantly. So I have a badge, you know, EOD badge, and I have the, you know, chevrons to say that I'm to be respected as a sergeant. But there are privates and specialists in my unit that have been in for, you know, been EOD for longer than I have. And Of course, there's some resentment. So it's a tough balance to have to learn and to recognize their experience while also being a leader. So thankfully, my first sergeant saw the dichotomy there and kind of bailed me out. He assigned me to, most EOD teams in the Army are three-person, a team leader and two team members. And he assigned me as this fourth member on a team. And I was learning with them, and I was pretty much doing the work of all the team members. But my first sergeant decided to send me to the JIDO sexy cell, counter explosives exploitation cell in Camp Liberty. And that's where the EOD teams, after they've collected the evidence off the battlefield, package it up and send it, and it gets triaged and sent to analysis. So it'll get analyzed for biometrics, chemical analysis, electronics, all that kind of stuff, and sent out like a storyboard format to all the agencies, DIA, CIA, ATF, DEA, FBI. So I went there to receive the packages from the battlefield and do the triage part. We would sort out and photograph, measure all this stuff and send it to the various departments for analysis. And it was a perfect learning experience for me because I got this higher level training. I got to see how, where our evidence and our storyboards go, how they like to see it come off the battlefield. And I had this extra training, extra experience that I could take back with me when I got my team.
Kind of being young in the profession and seeing it on a higher level, which always helps in the end because you see an end game to everything, which I think definitely helps you make decisions at the beginner level.
Yeah. However, I believe even at the entry level in EOD, they understand it's pounded into us and throughout the EOD training, EOD school, that this is a serious job. Even the slightest mistake could be the end of yours or your team's or others' lives. So there aren't a whole lot of goof-offs in EOD. They don't last long. However, I did absolutely recognize this assignment as a way to get that extra education, that extra preparation for when I did finally receive my team leader certification.
Let's talk about that stress level. There has to be no other stress like it in the world. Like you said, with the smallest mistake, it could be catastrophic. How do you deal with that stress, and how do you take that learning how to deal with that stress into this civilian life that you have now, into this profession that you have now? You had to have learned little bits and pieces and nuggets of information to use later on.
Yeah, we go through these stressors in our lives, like the chaotic times of our lives, and we get through them, and then it's like we become a little more resilient. And people talk about resilience like a rubber band where you get stretched and you come back to that same place. But humans aren't rubber bands. When we get stretched, when we endure some stress, we become stronger, we become better. We learn and change from that. Our synapses, the neuroplasticity and our synapses just reroute. And then we've assimilated that experience. So it's not, maybe the next time it's not quite as much of a stressor. Well, when I went to EOD school, they put the motto is like right over the door when you walk in. And I think it's right over the gate going into the training area, and it says initial success or total failure. That puts a pretty fine point, on the seriousness of the job. Okay, and you see that every single day. You don't start the day. That doesn't mean you start the day stressed out. That just means this is your new normal. So we start EOD school, and we might be a little spooked, a little scared, a little timid, of course, about the job, but we do it every single day. And we plan and prepare and we train for it so that when it comes time to do the job, we just do the job.
I think that is a simplified answer, though, because here's the thing. Whether you're talking about law enforcement, whether you're talking about military, first responders, it's very easy for us to say things and make it sound like it's very blasé. I don't think the average person knows, though, that kind of level of stress. Of course, like you said, we have stressful times in our life. We have all these things. If you make a mistake, an explosion goes off, and that's the end of it. Possibly for you, definitely for the mission.
Well, I know you've heard that saying, sweat in training so you don't bleed in battle.
Right.
And also in our school, we would have an exam. We would be tested every 2 to 3 days. The amount of information that were being crammed into us is incredible. The attrition rate is huge, not because of the physical requirements, but because of the mental requirements. Some of the questions or some of the wrong answers, some of the gigs on our tests, well, backing up, a failing grade, minimum passing grade is an 85. Because you don't want to see a student in a bomb suit. So,
true.
But there are some wrong answers on our tests, some wrong moves on our tests that are 16-point hits. Because if you made that mistake in the real world, it meant you die. And usually those are safety infractions. That's the very first thing we start learning is safeties. We have a whole list of them, HE, frag, EMR, static. Every one of them has, a meaning behind it. HE, high explosive. It goes boom really fast. And here's what it does. Frag, fragmentation. Here's what happens when fragmentation comes. That kind of stuff. And for every situation, we can point out what safeties we first need to observe when entering this dangerous area. And if we don't observe that safety, it's a 16-point or a deadly mistake. So it doesn't, no situation on the battlefield, especially not EOD, missions, are ever safe. But we train to mitigate the danger the best we can. That's the first thing we do.
So let me ask you, do you remember the first bomb, real life world, that you defused?
Well, the first live thing that I defused, all I saw was about 6 inches of dead cord in the dirt. This was in Afghanistan.
Okay.
In Iraq, I didn't run any live ordnance. I was, I was at the sex assault.
Right.
In Afghanistan, we were doing, it was during, that first left seat, right seat, turnover with another EOD team. I was out there in the field on a dismount mission, and I was doing the left seat. We saw it was a strange pile of 7.62 belt links, just weird, strangely piled up. And I think the insurgents realized that it would mess up our metal detectors. So we did a little bit of probing, a little bit of digging, and we just saw this bright orange line just kind of running in the hard packed dirt around a mud hut. Like, okay, that's not supposed to be there. But instead of just digging all day long, because somebody was probably watching, we called up a bit Roz, Air Clearance, and we just popped the charge over top of it, and side of the mud hut came down. So that was my first IED. I'm glad it was simple, it was easy, and we got away safely, and the mission could continue. There wasn't any reason to probe any deeper for evidence on that one. That wasn't the mission.
I know you said you're glad that you got away. Were you a little disappointed, though? Just human nature, a little disappointed that that's your first?
Well, it's not something out of a cheesy movie or anything like that. It's not a story you tell the guys at the bar. I've got plenty of those, but my first one was simple, easy. I didn't lose any fingers, and I didn't have to explain to my first sergeant why I screwed it up.
That's a very good ending to that story. Let's talk about more dangerous, more missions where you thought, okay, this is a little more experience right here. If we could, let's talk about one that you were really maybe nervous, not only with the nervousness of doing the job, but nervousness of looking around at the situation and going, maybe you'd never seen that. Maybe you were unsure of what to do. Can we talk about anything like that that happened with you?
There were a couple, but like I said, most of this AO was all the same thing. It's just I remember one time when we entered this small, very, very small village, and there was a like a T intersection in the mud road, dirt road, and we were a little bit back in the dismount patrol. The platoon leader called us up, and I said, "Where's the IED?" And he goes, "So there's one right there, one right there, one right there, one there, and one there. And I'm pretty sure that one's one also, but I can't be positive." And after looking at everything he pointed at, I said, "Okay, clear back, clear out, and set security, and our guys and I will get to work on this." 3 hours later, I had five IEDs, all pulled out of the ground. There's like a trip wire. They were all rigged, and I don't even think any of them would have gone off the way they set them up, but they were all live IEDs, and I had them all stacked, ready to dispose of when the battalion commander calls and says, "Stop EOD operations." Like, what are you talking about? They want to send a MLRS into the town and blow it up. And pretty much the reason to do so is because it's littered with IEDs. It's not littered with IEDs. They're in a nice, neat stack right now. All I got to do is pop a little block of C4. He said, "That's the orders. We're going to pull out with that, the gift wrapped for the insurgents. When is this, MLRS? When are these rockets coming in?" I don't know. 36 hours later. Thirty-six hours it took them to approve those 12 rockets. It was a hell of a show. We sat in a calotte about 600 meters away. I'm not sure if anybody had eyes on for the full 36 hours of those IEDs that were just wrapped in a ribbon on the side of the road. But I did my job, and I got I rendered it safe. And then, who knows where those rockets punted them.
Thanksgiving 2011. You go home. It's the last time technically being home, holidays, that you're going to be able to see, hear, do everything that you have always been able to do. I've always wondered in looking into your story, Is there anything you think back on to that Thanksgiving that really sticks out to you? The way something looked, the way something smelled, the way you heard something. Is there anything that stood out at that one that now that you think back on it?
The one thing that always jumps out at me is my dad, my son's grandfather, this bachelor in Orange County who loves drinking wine, smoking cigars and playing golf 152 times a year, rented a Mickey Mouse costume for my son's birthday, which is just, November 21st. So I got to, see my son turn one, and I got to, witness the whole family get together for Thanksgiving. And I got to see my dad dress up like Mickey Mouse. And that was priceless. That's one hell of a last page in the photo album.
When you think back on it, and I want to make sure, because it gets a little cloudy here. Were you married at the time to a first wife? Is that correct?
That's right.
You have one son at that time, correct?
One son at the time. Yeah. He just turned one. I was married to a previous wife, and then I was injured.
Okay. So all of this happens. Trip, in all ways that I can see, works out great. You go back to work, December 8th, 2011. There's something in the road. Can you walk us through this entire chain of events?
Yeah. So I was on my 2 weeks of leave, R&R from the battlefield. And then, flew back, went through Kuwait and almost bought a Jeep, everybody does.
Wait a minute. You're going over that quickly. I know people buy watches and they buy some nice things over there. I've never heard anyone say they were flying through Kuwait and almost bought a Jeep.
Yeah, the Kuwait transient area. You got like the Green Mountain. Was it Green Mountain Coffee, where everybody buys those ridiculous frappuccinos, and you've got like a little exchange, a Burger King, a KFC, a Subway, and a military car sales. And of course they've got—
Does this happen a lot?
Oh yeah, it doesn't, like so many the deployment, so many of these guys on deployments, they just see— it's the only thing that doesn't have an ounce, like it doesn't have a speck of dust on it, is the Jeep and the Harley sitting in Kuwait. But, and you've got that deployment money. But, I thought better of it. I'm a family man. I'm saving responsibly. But, man, I love Jeeps.
Okay.
I finally make it back to Kandahar and back out to, my AO. My team grabs me in our DERV, our armored truck. We jump into a supply convoy, heading back out towards our command outpost in Sia Choi. And along the way, we're on Route 1, the only paved road in the whole country. The convoy commander calls back and says, ANP has, found something inside the road up here. EOD, can you take a look at it? This isn't my AO. This isn't my, I'm not on QRF or anything like that, but it's either our team, which is ready to rock, or it's sit on the side of the road as we wait for the QRF, an hour later to come out and look at me like, what the hell, dude? So we let the convoy set up security. Then, I threw the luggage off of the robot and the robot out of the truck. It found, like we have been finding forever, this jug pressure plate, and the robot took just ripped it apart, ripped that pressure plate out of there, but it couldn't get the oil jug, the HME, out of the hard packed dirt. So I wanted to get the evidence to send up to the sexy cell, like I knew how to do, and that meant I had to get my boots on the ground. So I grabbed my evidence kit, a little drop charge for the stuff we didn't need to keep, and my metal detector. And I started making my approach about 20 meters or so from the original device. There was a secondary device that hadn't yet been found. About the same time, the metal detector was trying to tell me something very important. That's when I got punted into the air. The lights went out. My bell got rung like I'd never been rung. And I landed on my knees and elbow. And I was kneeling there on the ground, still awake, but I couldn't see. And I thought that my helmet had gotten pushed over my face. But before I could go to adjust that, I checked my fingers and toes and did a functions check and make sure everything was still there. When it seemed like everything was still intact, I reached up to fix my helmet just to find that there wasn't any helmet. It was gone. And that's when I thought, oh man, this is bad. My first sergeant's going to kill me for losing that. I knew that the next thing that was going to happen was my team, like they're trained to do, was going to clear a safe path in so the medics could treat me and get me out of there. I didn't want anybody to come into that dangerous area. There may be other secondary devices, tertiary devices. So I stood up and I started making my way back towards the truck. Of course, I can't see. I have no idea where I'm actually going. And it just looks like I'm, you know, doing this zombie walk around the battlefield. Eventually, my team grabbed me, dragged me back to our truck. The medic came from the outer cordon, huffing and puffing, complaining about making him do all that running. And within 14 minutes, the medevac chopper was there, taking me right back to Kandahar.
You passed out about 10 minutes in, or when the medevac got there, is that when you passed out?
I think I passed out on the chopper. Last thing I remember, the medics, you know, the crew on the chopper was just taking one of those, taking my watch off, one of those G-Shock. Yeah, those cool things with the compass and the barometric pressure you never need. And I'm thinking, don't lose that, dude. But of course, I'm never going to see you again. I don't know this yet, but not going to need that ever again. That's when I pass out. I wake up, I don't know when, I'm in CAF, and I wake up to our EOD battalion Sergeant Major standing over me. He says, "Sergeant Hale." "Yes, Sergeant Major." "Let me get this straight. You get blown up, and you stand up and you walk out of the blast zone?" "Yes, Sergeant Major." "You are fucking crazy." "Yes, Sergeant Major." And then pass back out. That was surreal. But the next time I wake up, I'm in laying stool, and I'm waiting 24 hours for the swelling in my brain to go down, so I can, you know, so they believe it's safe for me, safe enough for me to make the transatlantic flight with that high altitude. But it's 48 hours, and I'm, you know, from blast to me in Bethesda, Maryland, Walter Reed.
I got to go back to what I asked you originally. If you think everything happens for a reason, as you explain this, it's not even your area. Like, you're just coming in from leave. You decide to go out. It seems so improbable in numbers of that day, that IED, that secondary IED, you being on that convoy, you deciding that you want to go up there instead of waiting. Do you ever think of like the astronomical probability of that?
I don't know how astronomical. There are probably hundreds of them out there. But no, I don't think about that like that. I mean, I did. But for me, it was sitting at Walter Reed, and it was all sorts of questions, but they were all questions with no answers. Why me? Right? Why did I have to do it that way? Right? Why did I have to step exactly there? what if I'd done it a different way? What if I'd stayed one more day in Kuwait? What if I grabbed the next flight into Afghanistan? And it's just like this spiral with no answers, and it just led into this self-loathing, self-depression, defeat. And that's where I was at first when I was sitting there in Walter Reed. I'd call them my demons, those voices that sit on your shoulder and tell you that, the world's out to get you, that so many people screwed up. Now, all these things are out of your control, and you could have done better. You failed. You failed the army. You failed your team. You failed failed your family. But where does that lead? It goes nowhere. That's why I had to turn around and stop worrying about the what ifs. The why me's, right? I had to stop thinking about that because nobody can ever answer that. I had to start focusing on the things that I could control. And that was my emotion, and that was my response. It's like Dr. Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning. That's the difference that separates humans from the animal kingdom, is that space between stimulus and response is the ability to decide, how, are we going to react? Or which means we're a victim of the circumstance, or are we going to respond? We're going to think and control our actions, and then we are at least in control of ourselves. So again, I don't believe that, I don't know about destiny or fate, but I don't worry about it, because I don't have any control over that. I just have control over my emotions and my reactions.
So let me ask you, you talked about self-loathing, you talked about depression. Is there anger at all?
Oh, of course there was, mostly myself. Anger for not zigging when I should have zagged. Maybe angry that I didn't just pop, drop a charge on it and forget about the evidence. It was all angry about all sorts of things, but it's the same stupid, never-ending cycle, but there's no answer. And eventually, you gotta focus on something else, or you get stuck. You go down the drain with those emotions. So, I was angry, but I let it go. There's nothing to do with that. It doesn't help me with the rest of my life.
How soon after all of this do you know that you're not going to see again?
When did I learn that?
Yes.
It wasn't long. I mean, it was pretty clear that my my right eye was gone. In fact, my eyelids were fused together. Like I was doing this permanent wink thing and just had to do the gun with the fingers. But they thought that they could possibly save the left eye because a piece of fragment actually cut right through the bridge of my nose and then gashed my left eye. But after one surgery, they did, flash a light in there, and I couldn't see anything. And then it just began to, what they did was the gash, it sprung, basically the eye sprung a leak. So they replaced the fluid in the eyeball with this viscous, like an oil substance. And then it began to leak out. So they just couldn't save that either. It was just a couple of days at Walter Reed, and I knew I was going to be completely blind.
You got to explain how you feel, because that's something that a lot of people aren't going to know in life. How do you feel on the inside when you hear that? We've talked about the loathing, the depression, the anger. Can you tell me how you felt and really walk me through when you find this out?
Well, the other thing is, you get to Walter Reed and it's just a flurry of activity. You've got your family coming in. You've got the Department of the Army, you know, trying to get you to fill out paperwork, right? You've got nonprofit organizations coming in and people asking if they want to, if they can pray over you. You've got politicians coming in to shake your hand and say thank you for your service because it's right on the beltway. And there's really no time to yourself. And maybe that was a good thing. But also I learned that very soon on that with 100% blindness, when you're in total darkness, there's also, it also comes with an added bonus gift of a sleep disorder because you can't reset your internal clock, circadian rhythm, because our brain is actually reset. That sleep cycle is reset to sunlight. So even if you're almost blind, but you have some light perception, you can sleep. Your body knows, your brain knows when to tell your body it's time to fall asleep and it's time to wake up. I don't have that. It's like being on a permanent 26-hour clock. So some nights it's more or less, quote unquote, staring at the ceiling tiles. And many, many days, like midday, I cannot keep my head off my desk. I have to fall asleep. So I'm there on Walter Reed, all this activity is going on. They close for business, close for the night with just the night staff, and I'm allowed to go to sleep, and I'm just sitting there thinking. And like, man, I'm blind. I'm going to be blind forever. I'm not going to be able to do this. I'm not going to be able to do that. How am I supposed to be? I can't do my job anymore. They don't even allow colorblind people to do EOD. I can't be a soldier. I thought about all these things I can't be anymore. And it was like one of those things, self-defeating. And I started thinking about my family. I'm still alive. What can I do for them? How can I be a father and husband and a son, a brother, all of that? How can I still do that? And I started thinking about all those warriors up and down the halls of Walter Reed in military hospitals all around. They're all fighting their own personal battles. So why am I feeling sorry for myself, right? Some have it far, far worse than I do. But I don't have this monopoly on pain. I don't, I've got my own unique pain, but it's pain. The pain's inevitable in everybody's lives. Suffering is an option. And I learned that later. But at the time, I'm just thinking, I can't let my Joes down. I can't let these other warriors down. They're not quitting. I'm not going to quit either. So I'm not going to quit on my family, my blood, or my military family. And that's when I decided that, if I was going to be a blind man, I was going to be the best damn blind man I could be.
Was there any specific incident that led you to this thinking? Because that's a very mature way of thinking, but it's a very chaotic situation. Was there one event, or was it a culmination of things that finally just kicked you over that cliff and said, it's got to be this way or that way? There's only two ways.
I don't know. I think it was a combination that kind of preloaded. My mom is just an eternal optimist, and she just has a certain way of thinking. And frankly, it wasn't her first rodeo. My younger brother, I said, used to do roadside construction while I was stationed in Italy. his work truck on a roadside, you know, on a highway job site was T-boned by another contractor inside the barrels, going really way too fast, and threw my brother out of the truck. And he landed on his head, cracking his skull, breaking his neck, broken several bones in his body. A passing off-duty EMS driver was just driving by. You know, a medic pulled over and kept my brother alive long enough for the life flight to pick him up and take him to, you know, the closest hospital. He received permanent brain damage. He was put into a coma, you know, medicated coma for over a month. To this day, he's got permanent brain damage. He's got Parkinson's-like tremors down one side of his body. He has a pacemaker connected to one of those brainstem stimulators to counter shock the misfire down that side of the body. And my mom moved into the hospital to nurse my brother back to life for like 6 months. And my brother had to learn how to speak again. He had to learn how to walk again. And when my mom walked into Walter Reed for the first time, I heard her voice, because I could still hear at the time, even though both my eardrums are blown out. And she comes in with this bright voice, "Hi, honey." And all I could think was, "I am so sorry I did this to your other son." And she goes, "Oh, baby, not my first rodeo. We'll be okay." The other thing, though, was 2 weeks before I was injured, you know, when I was home on leave, I was actually in the D.C. area where my aunt lives, and that's where we did our Thanksgiving reunion. I found out about one of our fellow company EOD team leaders was injured and was at Walter Reed. So I was the first one there at the hospital to see him out of the ICU. And Kyle Vickers is just an amazing guy, hilarious dude, and a great personality. And I don't know if it was his personality or the, you know, just coming off of the anesthesia, but he saw me and he got this huge shitting grin on his face, like, "Hale, what are you doing here?" And they wouldn't tell me what had happened to him, but they let me go into his room before he came out of surgery. And I don't know if it was Wounded Warrior Project or whatever organization, there was a stack of clothes on the side chair by his bed, and it was like sweatpants, sweatshirt, t-shirt, and one shoe. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out. So he gets rolled in. Obviously, he's about like 70 pounds lighter in one leg. And he goes, "Hey, dude, I think I kicked myself in the face when it happened." And then almost in the next, I think in the next breath, he goes, "You know, the worst thing is it ruined an awesome calf tattoo." Okay, this guy, it's got to be the medication, but it's also, you know, there's his personality. So I'm there at Walter Reed now, and I'm blinded. I'm like seriously bummed out. And here comes Kyle rolling in the wheelchair. He goes, "Hey, dude, check this out." And he grabs my hand and he goes, "Here, touch my face." I'm like, "What?" And he puts my palm of my hand up on his chin. And he's like, "Feel that, man?" I'm like, "Yeah, you got some scruff there." "Yeah. Guess what? The Marine EOD techs here, they have this attaché or liaison something. And when they come out of ICU, and they come out of surgery, he asks them, how you feeling? If they say fine, he hands them a razor and says, get back into regs. We don't have an attaché. It's my All the army guys are growing their beards out and it's driving the Marine techs mad. You got to grow your beard out. I couldn't help but chuckle. It was that brotherhood, you know, it was having my buddy there. And then it could have been anybody, but it was great that it was him. I'm sorry it happened to him. But between my family and, you know, the support of my brother there, I couldn't feel sorry for myself for long. And I decided, you know, life is still happening here. Life's still going on. Whether I feel, I could be, you know, doing self-pity and feel sorry for myself for the rest of my life, life is going to go on. So I better keep up. And I better, you know, uphold my responsibilities because I'm not off the hook yet.
Okay, so let me ask you. Things are shaping up for you. Your mom's helping you out, ever optimistic. Your buddy's there with you. How's it going with your wife?
Is everything working out? Well, I don't have the same wife anymore as I did.
No. Yeah, I know. I understand that. But how is it going? Because you were still married when you were injured. How is she taking everything that's going on?
Well, she didn't take it very well. And I don't want to get too deep into it because we, you know, still have a son between us. But she didn't take it well. She wasn't prepared to be the spouse of a wounded veteran. Also, we had our difficulties before the deployment. In fact, it wasn't until, you know, we moved into our new home and I retired from the military and I could no longer deploy to get away from her that I had to face facts that the situation was untenable. And I decided, even though being a single blind guy was terrifying, I had to make a change and I asked for a divorce.
How hard is that to do, to leave everything that you've known? Now the military's gone. Now your wife's gone. Now you're a single guy. And I hate to sound like a grumpy Gus by saying it, but I just have to understand how you have this optimistic attitude about everything, because your life is completely different now when all of this happens. That's got to be terrifying, though, to know I'm already like this. I'm about to step off and do this single.
Yeah, the one thing I've learned is that life is perpetual change. And as soon as I start feeling comfortable, and this is like the same feeling when you're out in the battlefield, you're on patrol, when things are getting too easy, that's when something goes wrong or something has to change. So here I am. Yeah, and just I've gotten used to these almost chaotic, definitely chaotic at times, changes. But I knew that the situation we were in, it wasn't good for our son. It wasn't good for me. It wasn't good for her. And I knew that no matter how unknown the next steps might be, they had to be taken. It turned out to be the best decision because I was able to grow. I was able to learn better how to be this blind person and how to be a better dad and be present for my son. And then, of course, all these other changes were able to happen, like finding Michaela and starting another family, a new, you know, growing our family. So, you know, now I do have custody of my oldest son, and we now have 4-year-old identical twin boys. I just didn't want to be the only one that was confused. And started businesses, and I'm having an adventure. It just wasn't, it had to come from the very uncomfortable choice of doing something that was, you know, scary.
Okay. So has the other injury happened? Have you lost hearing yet? When you get a divorce, when you're moving on, none of that has happened yet, correct?
No, not yet.
Okay. So you've got a good outlook on life. You're approaching everything with this gusto, and then Murphy strikes again. And you got to be thinking at some point, like, shit, like, what? I'm serious. And when I say that, I say it, you know, kind of jokingly, but there has to be a point where you're like, what is going on?
Get this. Okay. I got divorced in 2014. I started running marathons. In fact, I registered for 4 marathons within the span of 4 months. I'd never run anything over a 10K in my life. And then 3 of them qualified me for Boston, which I ran in April of 2015. And I also started mountain climbing, climbed a mountain in 2013, all wounded veteran team of the, you know, in the Peruvian Andes. I climbed mountains in Colorado. In spring of 2015, I climbed 3 14ers in Colorado in a day. Went skydiving for the first time, which, meh, you know, it's kind of like sticking my head out of a fast car because I don't get the, you know, the benefit of the view. Started kayaking whitewater in a solo kayak. I was doing like class 3 rapids and on the Yellowstone River. And I was having these amazing adventures. I went hunting. I don't know if you can see that guy up there. Yeah, I got that guy blind. All is spring, early summer of 2015. I was 2 weeks away from climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. And I was gonna start on my quest to climb the 7 summits, and I get put in the hospital again, and I find out that, oh yeah, and I had this awesome first date with this beautiful girl named Michaela, and then I'm in the hospital and I'm going deaf. The doctor tells me you have bacterial meningitis. Probably from this leaking crack in your skull that hadn't been completely patched, you know, 4 years ago. And you're going to be deaf in, you know, a couple of days. First thing I said was, what?
Please tell me you meant that as a joke.
I couldn't help it. No, but seriously, the first thing I thought of asking the doctor was, so you're going to tell me I'm going to be 100% blind and 100% deaf. I'm never going to have to pretend to pay attention ever again.
To anybody.
I did ask. And my mom was there, and it was probably the bacteria, but I didn't hear her laughing. Again, it took me a couple of weeks to get out of the hospital. It was a terrible battle with this bacteria. I mean, migraine doesn't do it justice. It was so bad. The pain was excruciating. And it was taking not just my hearing, but my vestibular balance, that inner ear gyro, that was gone too. So I fall asleep and it felt like I was falling. So I would wake up jumping out of my bed. And thank goodness for the hospital, like handicap rails in the bathroom, or I'd fall off the toilet. Then I come home in a wheelchair and I'm just sitting at my breakfast bar and I'm thinking, holy crap. Again, like, why me? Right? When have I paid my fair share? When have I, you know, paid my dues? Right? When's enough enough? But it's like, why is this happening to me? And I recognized it, like, logically, I recognized what I was doing to myself, but emotionally, I couldn't help it. I was pissed again. And I was just sitting there, the whole world ending at my fingertips. You know, I was trapped in this body. I couldn't get a message in. All of the accessibility devices, all the talking computers and phones that I'd been using, the barcode scanners for my pantry to tell me what's on the labels, all silent. No audiobooks, no podcasts. I couldn't read my emails. I just stuck there with my thoughts. And I tell you what, you remember, you know, how everybody was complaining about how isolating that whole COVID quarantine time was? Like, welcome to my world, people. That's nothing. I just sitting there and I kept thinking, this isn't the way. I was mad. I gave myself time to process the emotions, but it was as though, you know, yeah, somebody up above was saying, yeah, put your money where your mouth is. Do it again. And I just started saying, instead of why is this happening to me, why is this happening for me? Why? What can I learn from this? How can I learn and grow? And how can I become a better me? How can I be me still? And then, even better than learning and saying, how can, you know, how is this happening for me? Why is this happening for me that I can teach to others, that I can share? And I'd been a public speaker for the last 4 years, been talking all over the country. And I thought, okay, this is just going to make me a far better speaker. This is going to give me so much material. I better get to work. And also, I still have a job to do, right? I'm still a dad. I'm still, well, at the time, a boyfriend. And I wear these hats. I'm still retired, but I'm still a soldier at heart. I'm still an EOD tech. I'm in that family. And I wear these hats. I wear these roles. And my life doesn't belong to just me. You know, it belongs to all of them. And it was funny, like, you know, I never seriously contemplated becoming, you know, one of the 22, right? A day. I can certainly understand what they might, you know, they might be feeling, right? But if I wanted to, you know, make a quick exit, I couldn't. I would have to put it up for a vote and by committee, and I don't think I would have the votes. So I'd better get busy living, right? And that's what I did. I started, I got on my treadmill, and because of my balance thing, I would just hit the quick start button and just like half a mile an hour and start walking, and I would hold on to the handrail with an iron grip, and I would do cadence in my head, sing, you know, in my head songs, the lyrics I could remember. And I just walked, and then I would go a little faster, and then I'd be jogging. I took the trekking poles that I once used in the mountains just to get out to the mailbox and back, and it would be exhausted. But the next day I would do it again. I would go just a little bit further. And then Thanksgiving was coming again. And I started, you know, and decided, Michaela, I had like this first date with her. She was working and living in California, and I convinced her to come out for a week-long first date / vacation in Florida. And we had that thing. It was awesome. And she went back home, and I contracted meningitis, and she flew right back out. It was days, like 4 days later. And she flew right back out. And she never left. She stayed. She nursed me back to health. And we started this life together. I mean, there are far less elaborate ways to get a second date, but it worked. Yes. It worked.
So let's talk about her. You talk about her a lot. Let's hear, like, when you think about her, what comes to mind?
She's an incredibly giving person. she cares so much about her family, about these businesses that we've built together. And, you know, now she's given so much over the last few years to make sure that I stayed alive. We went through a pretty tough custody battle for my son. And she's an amazing spouse and an incredible business partner, and really fun to parent with. So I'm a very lucky guy.
When you do this, when you get married, when you do all this over again, because you got a divorce after the injury happened and stuff, is it ever in the back of your mind that you're worried? What if something else happens? What if she can't handle this? Like we talked about with the first one, that she didn't care about, not care about that, but that she didn't take it well. Does that come into your mind at all?
Well, we talked about it at length. Right. And in fact, my ex being my ex was a huge part of our lives for a few years. As the divorce was ugly, the custody battles is ugly. So we discussed things and we talked about, like, is this really a life you want? You really want to be married to a deaf, blind guy? Do you really want a life like that? And somehow she can see through all that to me. And I don't know, she was already put through the gauntlet right at the beginning. So she's been initiated. So when the wedding came and we wrote our own vows, we kept them easy. She promised to keep the house stocked of bacon and bourbon. I promised to never let my eye wander. Unfortunately, these are prosthetics, and anytime I get like something in there and I gotta clean it, I tend to every once in a while spin the thing so it looks like a lazy eye. So she's been able to keep her vows. I have not been able to keep mine.
At least you can admit it. That's the first step to recovery, so is that you can admit it. So let's talk about all these things that you guys do, because it's simply amazing. Now, I know you started with the Thanksgiving dinner when you were trying to get back on your feet, when you were trying to live this life. You took weeks to plan the menu and everything that was going on. And I got to tell you, your cooking without looking is, one, hilarious, and two, the food is absolutely amazing on there. Let's talk about that Thanksgiving when you're getting back onto your feet, and then how it led into this company of confectionery, delights for people.
Well, I told you I was like sitting there feeling sorry for myself, and I decided I wasn't going to do that anymore. Actually, after a little while, you kind of get bored. It was true. I was feeling sorry for myself, and then I'm like, okay, now what? I had to do something. And I literally had to do something. And I tried to, what can I do? And I could walk to the mailbox, and I could get on the treadmill, and I could do those things, and my legs still worked, even though they're a bit wobbly. I could still cook. And, something I love to do, and it was just kitchen therapy, right? It was just cooking. I would make a meal for the family for dinner. And then Thanksgiving was coming. So we decided we're just going to throw this huge feast. We're going to make it a party. We're going to invite the friends and family, even because I retired close to the EOD school. We even invite some of those students that get stranded over the holidays, don't have the leave or the money saved up and want to keep it for, Christmas, New Year's. So we adopt a few of the EOD students into our home. And we had this huge feast. I started weeks in advance. I started making cakes and cookies and pies. I started making batch after batch of fudge, right? I made this fudge recipe that I could change all the like the different flavors of chocolate and different spices, and every batch of throw some nuts in there and a little spice there, we'll go to the liquor cabinet, a little bit in there, a little bit in there. And Michaela said she noticed two things. She hadn't seen it in like 6 months, because it was a long time I was stuck in my, you know, without before the cochlear implant. One, she noticed, was a smile on my face. I was actually enjoying what I was doing. I wasn't thinking about what I couldn't do or what I lost. I was thinking about what I could do and what I could make, right? And the other thing she noticed was the fudge was piling up. There was just more than even our guest list could finish. So she started sneaking it out the front door. You don't have to be real stealthy around a blind deaf guy, but she was giving it away. Neighbors, friends, and they started coming back and asking if they could buy some for a birthday or baby shower or something. And the capitalist in me said, well, of course you may. And before we knew it, we had this business, Extraordinary Delights, or EODfudge.com. And it was just, it's really snowballed quickly. We developed a few flavors. We started buying like the packaging, shrink wrap. It was so funny. You know, my garage is like this pretty admirable home gym. And I've got, you know, the squat rack, I've got a stationary bike, treadmill, rower, and then the shrink wrap machine. We started selling it, we built this website, and then it just grew from there.
How proud are you of not only you, but of Michaela too, about everything that you've overcome to lead to this life right here?
Well, I think I needed to. I had to endure all of that. I had to learn and grow from all of that. We don't get stronger despite our hardships. We get stronger because of them, right? We don't get stronger despite going to the gym. We get stronger because we go to the gym. We've got like this phobia of hardship or stress, or, you know, we don't want discomfort. We want, you know, perfectly tuned in, you know, perfect temperature on the AC, the perfect cushiness in our bed and our sofa. And what happens is we're actually shooting ourselves in the feet, right? We need to get out there. We need to go do some hard climbs, you know, go hiking. We need to carry some weight on our backs. We need to test our minds and, you know, challenge, you know, our brains and our emotions sometimes. We need to go do things that are uncomfortable for us, things we think we might not like. We just got to go do it because we need to, you know, for our own survival. So everything that I've been through, it shaped me into the person that I am today. Sometimes literally, but all of those things, while terrifying, while painful, you know, extremely sad and extremely, you know, angering at times, I need those. I knew those experiences to appreciate and to have the kind of gratitude that I have for my life now, to be the person I can be, I need to be for my sons. I had to go through that.
Let's go all the way back to the beginning. Definitely weren't living your full potential in junior high, high school, even college. You think you've hit your full potential now?
You know, I like how Ed Mylett puts it. He's chasing the guy he's supposed to be. You know, when he reaches the pearly gates, he's going to be greeted by a man that looks just like him. And the guy is going to say, welcome. Congratulations, you made it. You caught up. I think that's a pretty great metaphor, great way to picture it. I don't know if I've reached my potential yet. I know I haven't, actually. But hopefully I'm on pace. Hopefully I'm getting there.
All right, so what do we got next for you?
What's next?
Yeah.
You know, I just finished running a really hard race across Death Valley. And my feet are just healing. We've got, so the fudge business is doing well. We parlayed some of the profits from that business into starting a real estate business. Michaela became an agent. I just started my own podcast a few months ago. It's doing pretty well, and I'd like that to grow as well. So we're growing our real estate business now. We're growing a podcasting enterprise. And I'm an ultra-running athlete. My coach just got back home, just like I did. And she sends me a text, says, how about a 100-mile stage race through the Himalayas? I'm like, oh, come on. My toenails haven't fallen off yet. But I don't know. I like having these challenges. I like having something to work towards. I've got plenty of them going on right now. So right now is just a pause so I can appreciate what I've got, spend a little time, a little less time on the treadmill, a little more time running around with the toddlers.
All right, where can everyone find you? And let's talk about everywhere someone can find you.
Everyone can find me at pointofimpactpod.com. That's a podcast, or of course on all the podcast platforms. It's a Point of Impact podcast with Aaron Hale.
You got way more than that. You got social media. You got the dessert coming. Get them all out there, Aaron.
Oh, of course. Yeah. They've got a sweet tooth. You can find some pretty awesome treats at eodfudge.com. And the social media links are on both those websites, the podcast or the fudge website.
Well, Aaron, I'm so glad that we got together, talked over email, got this taken care of, because your story is absolutely phenomenal. You are a true inspiration to people that think they may have it bad, but, sometimes I think they don't know the half of it. You've been through it and came out stronger, I think, on the other side than I think you thought you could ever be. And I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and talking this week. Guys, you know where you can find Aaron. Let's talk about where you can find me. As always, you can find me on Instagram at @DTD_podcast. You can find me on Facebook at @DTD Podcast, and you can find me on YouTube, where all these conversations are in video form. But your one-stop shop, DTDpodcast.net. It's audio, video, pictures of Aaron, all of his links, able to buy anything that he's selling, get a hold of those treats, and listen to Point of Impact. Now that we've talked about everywhere you can find me, let's talk about our amazing sponsors, Mack Belts and Police Coffee. Let's talk with Mack Belts. We all know that nothing stands up to wear and tear like a good leather belt. And if you're looking for the toughest leather belt on earth, then you've come to the right place. Mack Belts. They're handcrafted in the USA by veterans who are serious about their craft. If you're looking for a belt that's tough enough for your active lifestyle and helps support those who've given so much to our country, you look no further than Mack Belts. It's the toughest belt on the planet. And let's talk about the Governor. Laser cut from premium synthetic polymer and an impressive brake strength of 1,500 pounds. It's 1.5 inch width. It's handmade right here in the USA by SOF veterans. Precision machine for the Mack buckle and with the Mack buckle. A low profile and lightweight synthetic belt solution. Expertly designed to be unbreakable and all weather capable. It's a perfect solution for casual or dress wear and ideal for utility or firearms carry. Don't forget to check these guys out, MackBelts.com. Let's talk about coffee. Let's talk about my favorite, One Ranger. You're sure to love it. It's flavorful, medium-bodied coffee with a smooth and sweet pecan flavor. Now, as we all know, pecan coffee is probably the best combination in the world. The pecan is rich, it's sweet, it's nutty and buttery. Its flavor cuts right through the coffee's natural acidity to give you a smooth and satisfying experience. And let's talk about Police Coffee. They're an officer-owned business and they're dedicated to crafting the finest coffees and blends and shipped as soon as they're made to provide you with the freshest coffee available. Their coffee's some of the best you'll find, but it also helps serve an important cause and we talk about it every week. They give back to our community. 50% of their profits go towards helping family members of police officers who fell in the line of duty. So please go check them out. They got whole bean. They got ground. They got K-cups. They've got dog treats. They've got coffee mugs. They've got everything you could possibly need to get your coffee fix on. PoliceCoffee.com and MacBelts.com. Please go out and help them. They make this show possible. Guys, that's going to be it for this week. That's Aaron. I'm DJ. This has been the show. Make sure you catch us on the next one. We're out of here.